It's our Tech Update Monday. And the second Monday of every month on the Larry Mueller Show, we set aside for technology and the latest and answers to your tech questions, from the basic to the complex. And whatever questions you have, our experts are here to answer. Today, our guest is Beth D'Angelo. She has worked in IT for more than 20 years now. She's a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And she's here to answer your questions at 1-800-642-1234. If your computer's giving you a headache, if your printer can't find your computer, if your internet can't find your printer, well then, we've got answers for you today at 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And Beth, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me.
And before we get to the questions from our callers and emails, I want to start with artificial intelligence today, because you didn't need to look any further than the commercials during the Super Bowl last night to see the ubiquity of AI as it is now here, at least according to the Super Bowl ads yet last night. You had an ad for Claude, the AI agent, which was making fun of ads included in AI, which evidently was a dig at the artificial intelligence company OpenAI's ChatGPT. You had Google running ads for their Gemini AI, promoting its guided frame and magic eraser. For some reason, you had Amazon featuring their Alexa Plus, with actor Chris Hemsworth being repeatedly attacked by artificial intelligence in a way that may have made some people wonder, why would I want Alexa Plus to try to murder me? You had Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, with their what they called athletic intelligent glasses, partnering with Oakley. There was Matthew Broderick. I mean, it goes on and on with his AI-powered app development company, Base 44, I think. Artlist.io had an AI-generated ad in the Super Bowl yesterday. It seemed to be the most common product being pitched at the most expensive 30 seconds on TV that we have. So what can we make from the ubiquity of AI after what we saw last night during the Super Bowl's ads?
Yeah, it was really interesting. To be honest, I didn't watch much of the Super Bowl. I did catch maybe that half an hour before and after and during the halftime show. But there were so this was the first time that mainly AI-generated Super Bowl ad has played.
Hmm.
So we've hit kind of a watershed moment where rather than relying on skilled content creators, who have, artistic abilities and education and background and expertise, they're leaning into these AI platforms to actually generate the Super Bowl ads. So it feels very like a strange new horizon we're crossing.
Strange new horizon brings us to the stories I saw last week in the BBC, the Washington Post, the New York Times, about a social media network that was dedicated just to apparently artificial intelligence. It's called Moltbook. And if you were to believe the first few days of this social media network for AI agents, it would seem that the AI had gone rogue, had come up with their own language that we couldn't understand, had its own religion that we weren't invited to, and it had its own sort of bill of rights for its what they expect about how they should be treated. I'm curious, Beth, did you see any of these stories, and what your takeaway would be for a social media network for AI?
Yeah, it's a really interesting development, and it reminds me a lot of the days of SimCity. I don't know if you remember that game, SimCity.
I don't. I played
it. Sims,
yes.
And yeah, it got really big, and there's whole worlds and all that.
Yes.
But back when it first came out, it was kind of an astonishing thing you would set up a world, and then you would set certain parameters and let it run and see what happens. And I see a real similar kind of parallel here in how people are looking at this new Moltbook phenomena, I guess we can call it, where it's really bots interacting with bots. There is no, supposedly, no human interaction involved in the creation of content through this AI social network. So I'm not sure why they're calling it a social network, because there's really nothing social about it. It really just feels like we're kind of watching ants in an ant farm do their thing. So I don't know. It's very, very strange.
So when we're talking about bots, then could you explain what these things are that are apparently interacting in their own network?
Yeah, bots are like essentially an interface from a large language model or an artificial intelligence data set. So it is some code that's written that pulls from either a specified data set behind it or publicly aware data sets that are out there, large language models, image archives, things like that. These bots then use that data to target kind of specific functions. So you could program a bot that's meant to repeat certain tasks and use information from a certain data source in order to repeat that task. So it's really just creating kind of like an automaton to do something based on a data source behind it.
So in theory then, Beth, considering this social media network, could I create a bot that says, go on to the Moltbook social media site for AI and create a religion? And then is that the AI creating a religion, or is it me? The same with language and an AI's Bill of Rights.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, now you can create a bot to interact with other bots to, inform the larger ecosystem that these bots are living within. So I guess in a sense, there is a way that humans are contributing because humans are the ones who are creating these bots. But there's a lot of skepticism around whether or not there actually is human interaction behind the scenes.
Right.
And some researchers out there and experts in the industry call this kind of AI theater, or more of like an experiment for people to see what autonomous intelligence actually does when left alone.
So we may be seeing more of a puppet show than actual, life being created in the inner tubes of the internet.
Yeah, I mean, it's creating like a simulation of life, which is somewhat what SimCity did.
Right.
Unless there's some way for that, like that doctrine or whatever it's creating, to output some force into the world to, take that whatever policy or religion or language it's creating, and I guess put that out into the world in action. It's really just theater then. It's a thought experiment.
It has been interesting to sort of keep an eye on and watch and see what happens, but it doesn't seem to be, I mean, like SimCity, it's not actually creating cities. It's creating what you would watch through a screen that would be like a virtual city.
Yeah, it's really what it's doing. It's modeling based on whatever data it's pulling from. So it's taking these large language models and image repositories and data sources, and it's coming up with the most likely scenarios based on reacting to other bots.
It reminds me of a cartoon I saw last week that was a guy in front of a computer that's typing in, say you're alive, and then the computer outputs, I'm alive, and the guy says, it's alive! maybe not quite yet, but it does appear that we... that there is some momentum to getting to a place where we would have to question what online life would look like and what kind of rights and beliefs it might have. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I think really where the risk or the concerns come in is that the technology and the development of technology and the accelerated timeline of the development of this technology is far outpacing any ability to regulate or rein in what potentially could happen with some of these technologies. Mm. So, humans that write policy and regulate industries that create these technologies, we're always behind the curve in trying to catch up. But it feels like it's a much larger gap with AI than it has been with past technologies.
So for some, it may feel like this has nothing to do with me, but when I go to my Gmail, when I go to my Microsoft Outlook, I see that Gmail is now offering Gemini to help answer emails and organize my inbox. And I see that Copilot is just about everywhere that Microsoft is these days, and Microsoft, when you're considering the operating system, is just about everywhere, which then begs the question, and I think from your perspective, Beth, it's a perfect thing to ask. to what degree should I be giving the AI agents, whether it's through Google, Microsoft, Claude, or OpenAI, or any of these, access to my information, access to my inbox or calendar, and to what degree should I feel comfortable with that?
Yeah, that's a great segue and a great question. If I look at how we're dealing with this at the university level and how we're trying to protect data organizationally, and then I think about how as an individual I react to these agents being built into kind of the infrastructure of my life and my work. At the university level, we're really taking a very careful approach to investigating how these AI agents, bots and language models access our data, how they safeguard that data, how our licensing agreements with the companies that we pay an exorbitant amount of money to use their software products, how they are working to protect the data that the university is trying to safeguard. A lot of the more kind of deep diving AI agents that work within our Microsoft software, we're not yet allowing our users within the university to access university data with mm-hmm. those agents because we're taking this very kind of methodical approach to the cybersecurity aspects of it. Eventually, that will be available, but not without a lot of scrutiny. And as an individual and, thinking about this from a non-technical person's perspective, you really have to think about it in terms of the agents that you're using with companies like Microsoft or Google, some of the larger organizations out there that we've trusted with our data for decades now, privacy is built into the software that you're using. So there's privacy protections that are built into the cloud systems that house these that limit access to whatever you're inputting into it. They also, put many security safeguards in place that don't allow unauthorized access or crossover between those services. So it's not leaving the back doors that they can get in through, a third-party app to your data. There are some privacy-aware reviews that happen. So that's something that may be concerning to folks, that these companies may review conversations to be able to improve their systems. So you want to make sure what you're doing is being very thoughtful about how you set up your apps to safeguard your own privacy, taking a look at all the settings that come with those features, deciding for yourself what data you want this tool to have access to and what you want to restrict. And I think really what AI is doing at a macro level is creating a bit more of a skepticism amongst technology users, where people's eyes are being opened to, you can't just trust things instinctively. You have to really dig deeper and safeguard your own data.
So would you trust an agent, a AI bot, with your credit card information at this point, Beth, just personally? Like, say, find me some summer concert tickets are going on sale soon. Yeah. Go find me the best seats for the best price on Ticketmaster.
Yeah, I mean, I would ask it to do that for me, but the purchasing, I would actually go to Ticketmaster's website and use their secure socket, e-commerce platform that has very specific protections built in for money transactions. Those are governed by regulations that are already in place through something called PCI.
Okay.
And there are very high regulatory requirements for that type of e-commerce transaction. So I would still stick with trusted sources for anything dealing with healthcare, finances, legal situations. I would really stick to more traditional methods that we're comfortable with the cybersecurity aspect.
How is AI ultimately going to make money? And I think back to the ad yesterday for, I think, Claude from Anthropic, the AI company that was making fun of ads being included in AI answers coming from OpenAI's ChatGPT. If they can't include ads as part of the artificial intelligence that we engage with, how are they going to monetize this? As you know, there's a lot of talk of how much money is being lost or invested into AI without seeing a turn of profit yet.
Yeah, so that's a kind of, if you look at a lot of like emerging technologies of the past, that's how they started off. Look at Amazon, for instance. Amazon ran in the red for, I don't know the exact number of years, but for several years after its inception, it was not making money. It was actually losing money because they were really working on undercutting pricing in order to gain market share. So right now, while these AI platforms may not be generating a lot of income, they are generating income, but not the huge amounts that you would expect, like something like Amazon. What they're doing is gaining a captive market. And then comes the monetization.
Then the ads get injected in your AI answers. Then the bots have...
Somehow. Yeah.
Beth D'Angelo is our guest. She's worked in IT for more than 20 years and is a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. It's our Tech Update Monday. And that's the AI portion of the show, unless you've got more questions. We've got more tactical things to get to, like Microsoft saying they are purging some of the printer drivers for legacy printers and what that may mean for connecting your printer to your computer. Taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Larry's back tomorrow, and coming up at noon, we'll take a look at the technology addiction and how you can scale back on your screen time and how to know when it's too much. Also mentioned, we'll take a look at some of the wearable technology today that is being used at these Olympic Games. That's after 12:30. But right now, our guest, Beth D'Angelo, senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, answering all your tech questions at 1-800s and mine at 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. And Beth, Dawn in Madison emailed. She's got a Galaxy S2 cell phone. It's been super slow for a couple of weeks now. She needs to charge it quite often and also has to restart it to get it to react. So is this because it's been compromised? Does she have some sort of virus? Dawn's careful about searching online, doesn't sign into sites that require a password. She does have the free Malware Bytes app that you've talked about in the past on this show for scanning, but it always says there's a poor protection after a scan. What should Dawn do to fix her cell phone issues?
Yeah. So if it's charging slowly, or if it, you know, seems like you're not getting a full charge in the normal amount of time, you know, one potential possibility is that the battery may have a dead cell within it. So it's not fully charging, or it's charging slow. But something that people forget to check is the actual like charging port that you're plugging into. Really important to make sure there isn't any like lint or fuzz or, you know, too much dust in that port. And sometimes it gets a little caked up and those pins of the charger don't actually touch the cord as well as they should. So cleaning that out with a toothpick really gently, or like a you know, a little bit of cotton may help with the charging issue. But if you're getting errors on the phone, you know, something about a poor, and it didn't catch the last part. It was,
yeah,
like
she says there's a poor protection after she runs a Malware Bytes scan.
Yeah, poor protection. Yeah, it sounds like maybe their poor protection would be related to not having a lot of antivirus or anti-malware software running on the machine. So maybe just making a recommendation to download something that'll put a better protective software on the system. So
what about resetting your phone to its original factory start to get rid of whatever might be in there? And I think most phones would have a feature where you can go back to how that phone originally came to see whether or not you can get some of the bloatware out of there, or maybe resetting it to the factory settings with a Samsung would restore some of the bloatware that comes with it.
Yeah, that certainly can help. Although there, even when you restore to factory defaults, when those phones come from the factory, there's a lot of bloat on them already. Yep. So, you know, restoring it to factory defaults and then actually going through and removing apps that you just don't need or want that are on there by default is also something that might speed things up a little bit.
If the battery is dying, is it worth it to send the phone out to get a new battery? I can't imagine being without my phone for a day, let alone a few weeks, especially considering multi-factor authentication, which all seems to be through my phone. But when would I you know, how would I weigh getting a new battery against getting a new cell phone?
I think I would kind of make the decision based on if I had a local company that was able to do it same day. In-house rather than having to send it off to a manufacturer to replace. Now, if you're doing like a warranty replacement, you don't have much choice. But if it's an older phone that you're looking to extend the life of, it may be worth looking into a local electronic shop. It's not terribly expensive to have done at most places. I would think certainly less than buying a new phone.
Yeah.
$100 to $200 is probably my best guess at what it costs right now. It's not a very difficult or time-consuming task. It probably would cost about the same as replacing the screen.
Okay. So that sounds like if you clean out your charging port and you still find yourself slow to charge, or it doesn't get a full charge, finding a way to get a new battery as quick as possible might be a good way to go before you decide to invest in a new cell phone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those are all definitely good options for trying to extend the life or continue to use the phone that you have. The cell phones are really getting exceedingly expensive these days.
Yeah.
Now, you know, a new iPhone is, you know, about $1,000. I don't think I want to spend $1,000 every couple of years to replace, you know, my pocket computer. so getting that to last, you know, 3, 4, or 5 years, especially, you know, in the economic times that we're in, is becoming more important.
Pocket
devices are less disposable.
Yeah, that's almost an understatement to call it a pocket computer. It's my pocket everything at this point. And it's my wallet. You know, it's my IDs. It's my insurance cards. It's my shopper cards. It's everything. And it's amazing to think, you know, what would happen if I cracked a screen and wasn't able to access any of that for just a day. I'd be shut out of pretty much most of my daily activities. That's it.
We become really reliant on these things very quickly. And when it's not available to you, you know, we forget very quickly how to fall back on our older resources to do the same things. So, you know, trying to find your way somewhere without Google Maps these days, I don't know. I wonder if I remember how to read a map properly.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, no, back to the old days of circling the drain until you somehow stumble upon it. I remember that.
Or, heaven forbid, stopping to ask for directions.
No, I am a man. I don't stop to ask for directions. I just keep going until I'm done.
you just ask Siri now. You know.
Let's go back to your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Gary in Sheboygan, good morning.
Yes, thanks for taking the call. I have a HP printer that's probably around 2 years old, and we used it very little, and then all of a sudden it wasn't printing anymore. Paper was going through, but it wasn't printing. And I thought, well, okay, it was the ink cartridges. Replace the ink cartridges. Same thing. It just won't print. It acts like it's printing, but it's not printing, even though the cartridges are filled with ink.
And I can hear your frustration, Gary, because those printer cartridges can be as expensive as the printer itself. So when they're not spitting anything out, where do you start to look for where the problem may lie, Beth?
Yeah, so it could be a couple of different things. The first thing I would do is run the clean printhead tool on the printer. So I don't know if your printer has a display on it where you can choose a utility menu and then run through the different maintenance tasks, or if it's an app that's on your computer or your tablet or your phone that you would go through to do it. Sometimes you have both. But running the clean printhead function, sometimes we'll get that glitch to figure itself out. Sometimes the spray nozzles for the ink need to be realigned, and the printer might not be throwing an error about that, but if you clean it, then it'll fix. The other possibility is that there's an issue with the driver, and that would be that's the software that connects your computer to the printer. And if it's a problem where this only happens from the computer, and you're able to print from, like, say, your cell phone or your tablet. But when you try to print from the computer, it comes out blank. That would definitely point to it being a driver issue instead of a print head issue.
Gary, is this one of those printers that comes with an app, or you get an app for your smartphone that connects to your printer? Are you able to print a test page somewhere, or do the clean nozzle function?
Well, I'll have to take a look at that because it's associated with my internet, wireless internet in the house. So, yeah, I'll have to take a look at that.
Because it sounds like it's getting the feed and something's telling it to print. But if nothing's coming out, yeah, the inkhead is something I would think of. And printing a test page from either the actual printer itself or from an app that you download. But also there is the story of these drivers, but I can't imagine. And again, Beth, before we go any further on the driver as a potential problem, can you explain what these drivers are and how they interact with our other hardware and computers?
Yeah, essentially the drivers are the software connectivity between two devices. So there are certain parameters that devices need to agree on in order to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And the drivers are really what conduct that communication between the software of your computer and the hardware of the printer device. So it's a really integral piece of like middleware in between the device and the program you're using.
So it may be a need to update the driver because the driver may be partially telling the printer to just spit out paper, but no specifics on what sort of ink to use.
Right. Like it's talking to the printer, but it's not actually sending the data over. So the printer is just spitting out a page. Sometimes that happens if there's some sort of a driver issue. Reinstalling the drivers usually fixes that if that's the cause. But a way to test that theory out would be to try to print to it from different devices.
Okay.
So if it's on your Wi-Fi network and you can connect it from your phone, try to print to it from your phone. And if that comes out printed, then you know the problem is with the computer, and that's probably a driver issue. And the other one quick piece of advice is if you're going to let your printer sit for a long period of time without using it more than a month or two, I recommend taking the cartridges out and putting them in a Ziploc plastic bag so that they don't dry out.
Oh, in a physical sense, would you run like a Q-tip with a little alcohol on the nozzle to see if you could loosen up anything that might be lodged there? Or is that something you'd stay
with? No, that's okay. Where I would use the clean print head feature,
okay,
because the printer itself will go through a routine to clean out anything dried in that nozzle. That may be preventing it from actually printing out on the paper.
Gary, I hope we found a potential solution for you there, but I saw this story over the weekend in a number of places. I'll cite tomshardware.com. Microsoft announced it's purging Windows 11 printer drivers, and now some of the legacy printers face extinction. Gary said his printer's only 2 years old from Hewlett-Packard. I can't imagine that his two-year-old HP is included in this, but some older printers may not be able to engage with Windows 11 anymore because evidently, Microsoft has gotten rid of these drivers?
Yeah, it's not really as dire as one would think,
okay,
because Microsoft isn't the only source for these drivers. Microsoft does provide drivers, between Windows operating system and various printers from, many different manufacturers. But the manufacturers themselves also provide drivers for their devices that connect you to whatever operating system you're using. So let's say you have a Canon printer that's maybe 5-6 years old and the Microsoft version of the driver isn't going to be available to you anymore. You can go to Canon's website and look up your printer model, and it'll have versions of the driver available for whatever operating system you're using.
Gary, thank you for calling, and I know you're not alone as somebody who has had printer ink all over him in the past. It's not easy to get off, by the way. We'll go to Todd in La Crosse next. Todd, good morning.
Hello. Hi. Hi, thank you. I have you jog my memory on that talk of cell phones. I have heard rumors that I should be charging maybe with a wireless pad charger. It might be marketing. Will that help the battery to last for more years rather than plugging it into the wall and charging to 100% every day.
Wow, Todd, I actually had heard the opposite, that a wireless charger could heat up your phone and that heat could shorten the lifespan of your battery or some of the electronics inside. Beth, I'm glad you're here to set us straight.
You don't even need me, Lee. You have the answer.
No, I do. I swear.
I was going to say exactly what you said. The opposite is actually true, that the wireless charging does generate quite a bit of heat, and that heat does degrade the battery over time. That heat buildup also lowers the efficiency of electricity flowing from the charging cable through to the battery. So they're saying that, you know, if you want to maintain like optimal battery health in your device, it's best to like avoid cycling between like 0 to 100% charging. So meaning avoid letting your phone get down to 0% and then charging it all the way to 100%. It's really ideal to keep your battery between 20% and 80% at all times. And most newer phones actually have a like a smart charging feature where it'll charge up to 80% and then it'll slow down the rate of electricity coming in through the charging port so that it's not overcharging the battery or overloading it.
So, Todd, you were half right about not letting your cell phone fully charge if you want to maintain the life of that a little bit longer. But those wireless chargers, those can be very expensive. Do we expect that the pricier wireless chargers would generate less heat or be safer? Or if I have a Google phone, would a Google charger be best? Or is it still the plug that would be optimal?
Yeah, I think, you know, the wireless ones are convenient. They're handy in certain circumstances. I think in the car, they're really nice to have.
Yeah.
Especially just with the MagSafe, and you just click it in and it's, you know, charging and it holds your phone for you. I think for short-term use, they're pretty helpful and convenient and won't cause a lot of damage. But I wouldn't put my phone on a wireless charger to charge it overnight while I'm sleeping and leave it on there for 7-8 hours at a time. I think your best bet is to stick with a wired charger for that.
And as you mentioned, smartphones are not getting any cheaper. So maintaining the life of them is probably just good business sense. Todd, I'm so glad you asked. Thank you so much for the call. Let's go to John in Menominee, Michigan next. John, good morning.
Good morning.
What you have for us? Yes, hello.
It's a printer question.
Mm-hmm.
I have a Hewlett-Packard laser printer, multifunction, like, scan, fax, the whole bit like that, and print. But when I try and scan, nothing happens. You know, I hear the carriage going in the printer, but when the test page comes up, there's nothing.
How old's your printer, John?
Maybe 4 or 5 years.
Hmm. And it's hooked up to a Windows computer? Is it just a PC?
Yeah, it's a Dell laptop.
Yeah. All right. Beth, what do you think?
Yeah, interesting. So HP has some software that works with the scanner printer combination devices that's called the HP Print and Scan Doctor. I would recommend downloading that piece of software. So you can just do a Google search for HP Print and Scan Doctor. And that software will actually run you through a series of tests to make sure that things are connected properly, that you have the right drivers installed, that the software you're using to view the scanned image is correct. And it'll let you run through some tests to see if there is some issue that you need to address. And probably give you some more answers than I can without being in front of it.
Right, so letting the doctor take care of it with the HP Print and Scan Doctor. That you download that, John, and run it on your computer and see what comes up with your printer, and hopefully that would solve it. But there's always the, especially with printers, it's a lot of moving parts. You're spitting out ink, and there's always the concern that it's not a software issue, that it could be something that's very mechanical in nature. And there's not a lot of opportunities that I see to actually fix the mechanical problems of our technology these days, Beth.
Yeah, that's an interesting development as well. Printers have gotten a lot less expensive to purchase the actual hardware of. So often, you know, with consumer-grade printers, doesn't really make a lot of sense financially to pay for someone to repair them. What is very expensive is the ink and toner that goes into them. The consumables is really where these printer manufacturers are making their money. So it really doesn't benefit them to provide service to be able to repair broken printers when really what they want to do is just sell you more ink and toner. So I would like, if I were buying a printer right now, my focus would be on what is the most ink or toner efficient printer that I can purchase if I'm going to be doing a lot of printing, because that's where your costs are really going to get high.
Don't necessarily look at the cost of the actual machine itself, but take a look at what it will take to replace the ink in that machine as you use it. That makes a lot of sense. Beth D'Angelo is our guest, and our time is running short already. So if you have a tech question for our expert, get it in now at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you are listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Larry Mueller returns tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show with Shylen Mergane, who is back to share how you can adopt an Olympic mindset and goal for gold in your own life. We'll also hear how learning improv is helping medical students and also the latest in pancreatic cancer treatment taking place at the UW Carbone Cancer Center. But right now, with the time we have left, we have Beth D'Angelo answering your tech questions at 1-800-642-1234 or by email at talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Nancy in Ridgeland next. Nancy, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I have a question about the same printer, I believe, the HP printer that the fellow before had, except it's a different problem, and it's been going on since I got it several years ago. I don't have it hooked in a wireless way. I have it in a wireless mode because that's the only mode it had, and I have a Mac laptop that sits right next to it. So when I go to print something, I'll hit the print, and the printer won't necessarily wake up, and the little icon on my computer is dashing back and forth saying, searching for printer, searching for printer, searching for printer. And it does that sometimes for maybe 20 minutes, 10 minutes, something like that. And then eventually it will print. So if I just leave it overnight, I'll have my print in the morning. But otherwise, and sometimes it jumps right to attention and spits my paper, my printed copy out. So what do you think?
I think that is incredibly inconvenient, but also, and I don't know if this will make you feel any better, Nancy, I have had the same thing happen right here in our WPR studios with our printers and our technicians here, where it's going to search for the printer that it already knows is there. It's just that the printer is asleep and won't wake up. So, Beth, what can Nancy do with her Mac laptop and her HP printer that doesn't seem to want to wake up, at least not on her time? Beth, are you there?
Apologies, I was on mute. Okay, I'm back. I was just explaining the whole thing. Anyway.
You missed it, Nancy.
Yeah, you missed it. Some HP printers have this deep sleep or auto-off feature that's built into them. We call it a quote-unquote feature, but it's kind of annoying. And if that's turned on, it'll go into this like auto sleep mode that may interact with the power management settings on your laptop, kind of in a way where it doesn't automatically wake up when you send a print command to it. But you can disable this. It's a little bit tricky to do, and explaining it over the phone would take a bit of time. But what I would do is do a Google search for the model of printer that you have and the words disable, auto off, or sleep mode.
Okay, so that would just, so it would be at the alert and at the ready for Nancy going forward if you could turn off that auto off or sleep mode. And the best way for Nancy to figure out how to do that step by step would be to type in her model of her printer into a search engine along with disable, auto sleep or deep sleep or auto off?
Deep, deep sleep or auto off is what it's called. Various models have different names for it.
All right, Nancy, I hope that helps. And thank you so much for the call, because I know you are not alone. We've got the same problem here at WPR. Or I shouldn't say we. Let me say me. That is my problem here at WPR. We'll go to Richard and Blair next. Richard, good morning.
Good morning. My concern is, and I'm very negligent, like walking along railroad tracks and not paying attention. I haven't saved my database in case of a failure. But can you back up your data from the computer using one software, and then in the future, having that software company go bankrupt, buy another software and back up the data with the other software, or is there going to be a conflict?
Huh. Beth, it's a great question, because how can we automatically back up our the things that we want to keep in the event of a hardware failure, and how can we make sure that we continue to back it up automatically in the event of a company failure?
That is a great question, because there are multiple points of failure in your ability to access your data. It could be that your internet connection isn't working and all your data is stored in the cloud and you can't get to it. It could be that the company that is storing your data in the cloud is having an outage and nobody can get to their data on their platform. It could be that your computer at home that you save your data directly to is having some sort of malfunction and you can't access it. And kind of combining access to all those things in one place where you can back it all up, including like cloud data, is really not available at this point. You have to rely on the individual kind of data sources. So if you've got Microsoft OneDrive data and you've got Google Drive data, you're really relying on those organizations to have some redundancy in place to avoid those catastrophic failures. They do still happen where people can't access their data that's in the cloud during an outage of one of those services. You can download those files to your local computer through that. If you're using Google, you can use their synchronization tool to sync your files between the two, so you have a copy on both. But as far as backing your data up that you store on your device at home, I recommend using a cloud backup service like Carbonite. That's the one I've been using for years. There's also iDrive is a big one that folks use. But that really backs up the data that you want to keep without making copies of the data you don't need to keep. So the stuff that just keeps your computer running, you don't need to back that up. But the actual data that you want to preserve for later, you can set an automated backup schedule so that it happens every day if you want it to back up anything that's changed. You can have it scheduled to run, 3 a.m. every night. It's going to back up any file that changed on your system from the last time it backed up. So those cloud backup services are really helpful for that.
And the two you mentioned, Carbonite and iDrive, Richard should not be concerned with those going out of business anytime soon.
And there's also Acronis, Backblaze. iDrive is I believe they're a partner of Microsoft.
Okay.
There's many of them out there. What I wouldn't do, I would not use a cloud storage service like OneDrive or Google Drive as a backup for your files that you keep on your computer at home.
Why not?
You're going to run out of space pretty quick and you're going to have to start paying for it. And it's very expensive. That should really be for data that you're accessing on a regular basis, things that you need access to, but not for like things that are, you did 10 years ago, but that you don't need to look at again, like your photos, or, you just need one copy of them, or you need a backup copy of them on something where it's cheap storage like Carbonite.
The thing I do, Richard, is I use an external hard drive in my home with like some of the concert bootlegs that I have and some of the music and media that I want to hold on to. I'll use an external hard drive and then a software program that will automatically upload things from like my music folder or my videos folder right into an external hard drive. So if my computer goes down, I've still got that data inside an external hard drive and I haven't had to rely on the cloud or encryption or anything like that for backup.
Yeah, it's also a great option having a secondary hard drive that you can back up to, whether it's internal or external. That's really helpful for keeping it local, especially if there's sensitive data that you're concerned about that you don't want leaving your home computer.
We've got an email from Sherilyn Merrimack, who is interested in where we started this hour, Beth, about artificial intelligence and the AI agents that are now in our calendars, in our emails. And she, Cheryl wants to know, where can you go to stop AI from assisting you in your Gmail? Where do you go to shut these settings off? And I've noticed that they don't make it easy.
Yeah, it's going to be different in every piece of software you're using. So you have an AI bot built into your Microsoft Office suite. So into Word, Excel, Outlook, those tools that you use for daily living, there is a way to disable those features. So you can turn off the enable Copilot function that is within Microsoft 365 in any of the Microsoft 365 apps like Outlook. If you go into the File, Account, and Manage Settings,
okay,
that's the steps. There is an option to either take the check mark out of the Enable Copilot checkbox or disable the Connected Experiences option in the Privacy Settings.
And do you know where we can go inside Gmail to do the same thing?
Let's see, in Gmail, let me get those specific. Gmail is in Settings, General, and then you go to the Smart Features. Then you want to uncheck Turn On Smart Features. So they make it a little tricky to find. You know, it's not intuitive.
I don't remember turning them on in the first place, which is always a little off-putting that the new features end up being automatically, you know, whether I want them or not. I have to make the decision conscientiously to not want them and then disengage them.
Right, Google is serving up something new, and you're going to like it, whether you like it or not.
And yet, as we started the conversation, it's something to be wary of and something to consider before you allow these language models into your personal information and where that personal information goes and whether or not it's even personal anymore with these language models from AI companies that are now Google and Microsoft turned on.
Yeah, it's very true. So as you see these new features appearing in apps like, Google, Gmail, Google Drive, your Microsoft Office suite of applications, as you see these features pop up, if they are not features that you intentionally want to use, yeah, I would suggest going in and taking a look at the enable-disable ability of that, whether or not you can turn it off. If you can't turn it off, are there privacy settings that you have the ability to control? I would definitely go in and take a look anytime you notice a new feature popping up that's AI related.
And to go back to Nancy earlier, who was having a problem with her printer, our answer was to why don't you Google that? But turning off Google features may not be the best Google search you want to do. You'd talked in the past about better search engines to use,
yes,
and DuckDuckGo has come up in the past. But when I face a tech question, I am always more inclined to go to a search engine and try to get a very specific question in a search engine to see if that's already come up, because if it's been a problem with my technology, chances are it's been a problem with others in the past as well.
Yeah, it certainly is helpful to, just be able to Google something, and Google has become, ubiquitous word like Kleenex.
Well, you're not going to say DuckDuckGo something.
Right. Yeah, DuckDuckGo it. It's just, it sounds silly. Go search on the internet.
You sound
go
old.
www. on the World Wide Web.
Oh, man.
So I think, taking Google as, we use it as a verb now instead of a noun. But there are a lot of options out there. DuckDuckGo is one that is frequently used by folks in the technology sector. It's one of kind of a favorite of tech geeks like myself. But there's also, if you're interested in other ways, there's an eco-friendly alternative called Ecosia that's kind of interesting.
Oh, wow.
Where they're kind of looking to lower carbon footprint. Folks are starting to use things like ChatGPT in a similar way to how they use Google. and connecting that with the environmental problems that those cause is, you know, is that a good use of resources? I don't know.
Something to talk about at another time. But Beth D'Angelo, yes. We thank you so much for your time today and look forward to catching up with you again soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lee. Take care.
Beth D'Angelo is a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, and we set aside the second Monday of every month for your tech questions, and we'll do it again in March. I'm Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Larry's back tomorrow, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.